Excellent. Good evening. It's Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, and even though we're in the midst of working our way through Volume 5 of the Secret Talks by E.J. Gold called Work of Groups, tonight we're on an aside, actually, because in our conversations last week, among other things, what we found is we wound up in the area of hospitality, and it was so important for us that we thought we should take a show and discuss hospitality, which we're going to do tonight. But as we usually do in this particular show, because it is on Work of Groups, each week our scribe, which is a highly paid professional scribe that we fly in each Wednesday night for this particular event, notates those elements that come out during the class that have to do with the elements of what is a group. And so what we start the class off with is a reading of that. And Ivan, is you going to be able to read that for us?
I hope so.
Thank you.
Wednesday, 9/6/2017, Work of Groups, number 25. Is that the meeting number 25, I take it?
Yeah. That was, yes.
Okay. Element, no, Roman numeral 1, elements of a group. Number 1, ascribe the distinction between a court recorder who types everything that's said and a scribe is that a scribe relays what happened. 2, a comment of EJ's from a different meeting was brought to the space to share with the group. The two most important guidelines for you to live your life by are the rules of hospitality and the way of compassion. 3, both elements, hospitality and compassion, involve acknowledgement of others. It brings in the second line of work.
Which, by the way,
we didn't even define that.
Did
yeah,
we?
No, it doesn't even sound familiar to me.
Go ahead and finish?
Well, I don't know. The formulation, the second line.
Okay, we'll come back to that. So okay. Make an asterisk.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to it.
Now, Roman numeral 2.
Asterisk.
Okay. First, that was elements of a group. Roman numeral 2 is operations of a group. Number 1.
Well done.
The art of invocational dinners is tied into offering hospitality.
There we go.
2, one of the exercises focused on splitting attention and putting 75% of the attention on the inner and 25% on the outer while being aware of being in the midst of your activity. And while working with a group, performing this split attention with self-observation and inner work, you can modulate and go to different levels of presence.
Can you read that one again, please?
Yeah, that was a long sentence, actually. Starting, you want me to read the whole, I better read the whole thing, huh?
Well,
it's 2, yeah,
okay.
Item 2. One of the exercises focused on splitting attention and putting 75% of the attention on the inner and 25% on the outer while being aware of being in the midst of your activity. And while working with a group, performing this split attention with self-observation and inner work, you can modulate and go to different levels of presence.
Okay. Modulate and go.
Yeah. Well, I would comment that this does come directly from a passage in the talk we were reading.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so that's something you should be. We all should be practicing all the time. In other words, like right now, I'm noticing, first of all, I'm talking, and on the verge of babbling, but I'm talking, I'm looking out around the room here, and I know that I'm kind of aware that I've got a piece of paper here I'm going to read, and yet at the same time, I'm more importantly paying attention to my being, the sensing of my own being. It's as important as any of this other stuff. Okay? And that's what that point was. Very important. It was in the last chapter we read in Work of Groups. And so it's a practice you should take with you. So you're sitting there, you're in a, you know, like I know Kay used to, you were selling for a while. You go out there and you're selling. It's a very complex situation. But are you paying attention to yourself? You know? And we've had some good meetings, you know, interestingly. So back to the asterisk of the second line of work. Okay. One formulation, and Silverdale, you can help me with this, that I've heard out there is that there are three lines of work. Work on self, work with others, or work of groups, and then work with the absolute, for and or for the absolute. So we're barely at the point of working on ourselves. We're just starting to learn how to do that, and then gradually start to work, learn how to work with others. Okay? So, Ivan, when you were reading the highlights, there was pretty clear that we had a couple of comments on hospitality.
Hospitality we touched
on. You know, hospitality and compassion. And this is, and we had a brief talk about this at dinner, and several, we were bringing up that this is a theme that has been ancient of times from in mythology, mm-hmm. and then, of course, in the 900th century B.C., when it was the Iliad and the Odyssey were formulated, were actually brought together, though I won't go into the history of those two books, but they were... a compilation of many, many, many ancient dialogues, and then they're brought forth vigorously there. So the ancient Greeks called the concept, it was fundamental to the Greek, the ancients, mm-hmm. in their methodology, and in both the Iliad and the Odyssey, they're demonstrated. And just briefly, probably the most sterling demonstration of hospitality in the Odyssey is when Odysseus comes back, he's finally freed himself from Calypso. Won't go into that. And he gets, and he finally makes it to shore. Poseidon is doing everything he can to drown him, but he doesn't. And he comes to the land of the Phaeacians. Do you remember this, Ivan?
Yeah.
And he's there,
yeah.
and he's beached on the shore, and he falls asleep, and he covers himself with leaves. He's naked. And then these young princess and these young women come to wash clothes, and they notice him. And he puts in all of the rules of hospitality, saying, you know, gosh, you know, I'm sorry to bother you, what you're doing, and he covers himself, and he just says, I didn't mean to, but, you know, I'm shipwrecked, and they go, oh, well, then you should come to our house. Mm-hmm. And the woman is the princess of the king and queen. They invite him into that. The first thing is, now listen to the mechanics of this. He goes in. They don't say, well, who are you and why are you here? Mm-hmm. They give him, they bathe him, they clothe him, they feed him.
Yeah.
They invite him to the high chamber of discussion.
Yeah, which is to say, and this is, you're talking about a shipwrecked sailor.
This is a shipwrecked sailor. It's all they know.
It's all, yeah.
Just some guy.
Yeah.
They never ask who he is, and in part of his role as a guest is to tell his story. So he starts to tell his story, and the king and the queen begin to understand who this is.
Mm-hmm. It's It's Odysseus.
Yeah. And they say, this is Odysseus.
Mm-hmm.
And but they don't interrupt to say, well, who are you? So there's no payment required of the guest.
Mm-hmm.
The host gives hospitality.
Yeah, and it's part of the, what would you call it, the process, the protocol, at least in Greece, is that the host is obligated to take care of the needs of that stranger, you know, that beggar or stranger or the person who comes and knocks at the door. In other words, whether that person is known or unknown, or whether anything, you know, whether his qualities are known or unknown.
Whether he has money to pay.
Well, it could be a beggar, it could be a criminal, you know, it could be a thief or whatever. But the obligation is to
exercise the protocol of the
to give food and drink to that person. And actually, in those ancient texts, it seems like it was part of the treatment of a stranger was to also to give them fresh clothes, to bathe, you know, have them bathe and to have fresh clothes, which was, I think, that's probably typical of Greek culture, and there were probably other ancient cultures where that was, you know, I think there's ritual bathing, for instance, in the Jewish tradition.
I'm wondering if that wasn't universal across the ancient world.
In India, they have a very similar thing, and all of it came about in the Greek theories are that it was Zeus was said, you must observe the rules of hospitality. And so the theory was that you never know when the divine is housed within this individual that is coming. So you should treat it as such. Treat it as such. And there's a specific name in India for it. Like, it's like the god. Is Grocki on right now? Yeah, he would know. But there's
law of hospitality, you say?
Yeah,
that's what it is. Well, now that you mentioned it, there are stories in certainly in Greek and Norse mythology of a god visiting among men incognito to see how humanity is behaving, and their treatment is going to depend on how they treat him.
Right. Yeah. I didn't have time to research it, but I think that was probably very widespread in ancient cultures. I mean, that's essentially in ancient Greece, they had, because Zeus's promise was to enforce this law, and so people were told,
right,
well, he's going to send messengers. He's going to send some, you know, I don't know whether
Athena
it was like Hermes.
Shows up.
Was it her? Well, he's going to send some of his cohorts, some divine entity, some divine person is going to go in disguise, because they're very good at disguising themselves, turn up at your door, and, you know, depending how you treat that person, Zeus is going to reward you or punish you. And I think the Greek story, the famous one, is, I think it's Deucalion and Pyrrha, something. There's an elderly couple are, you know, have this knock on the door, and there's two beggars come there, and do you remember who they were, Dan? It was
Zeus and Hermes.
Yeah, okay. It was a couple of divine personages, and they just looked like beggars. And these people, this was an elderly couple, and I think the way the story goes is they only had, you know, like one loaf of bread. You know, they had very little food in houses, but they sat these people down, and they gave them water to drink, and they went and said, oh, we only have this one loaf of bread, but here, we'll split it in half. You take half, and we're sharing our dinner with you, and so on. And so these people were lavishly rewarded, whereas a lot of their neighbors had spurned these beggars, you know, had spurned these individuals, and Zeus punished them resoundingly. Anyway, but that's, you know, in a sense, you could think of that as like a teaching story. This is a teaching story for the culture, you know.
And for us as well.
For children, let's say.
This is throughout, we see this. And there was a story, a very recent story, of a, you know, all of these giant Protestant churches, you know, the televangelists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the details of it, but they had a new minister coming
in.
Houston? I think it was in Texas. I can't remember the details of it. But the minister dressed like a poor guy. He would come to church messed up. He was like kind of dirty. He looked like a ruffian. He'd sit in the very back of the church and said nothing. And this was all like middle and upper middle class, white, of course, church. And he was off-putting to them. And they would reject him. They wouldn't want to socialize with him. And like a week later, whenever it was, a month later, he then steps out of that pew, goes to the front, and he goes, "I'm your new guy."
Really.
So we are always faced every day, all day long, with the opportunity to express and to find the ways and means to express hospitality. If we go out into the world, you will have that all the time. We are ambassadors of the work. We're ambassadors of this kind of material that we've been studying all our lives now, all our lives. And we go out into the world, we see our grocers or our mechanics, our dry cleaners, our, you know, we're out all day long doing various tasks, right? Are you expressing hospitality when you do that? Ultimately, of course, hospitality grew out of, and there's an enormous tradition in the tradition of the hospice movement. We think of it, you know, right now, what it's like. But it's, you know, in the first, in the Middle Ages, there were houses of the poor and dying. That's what you would do. These were poor people and they were going to die, but they got taken care of anyway. And there were, the modern hospice movement started in about 1960-something or another. a nurse started it out of. But so the concept, think about that hospitality, of providing hospitality to the dying person. They're just, how do you do that? How do you provide hospitality at that point?
Piangelo says that the archangel Raphael often appeared incognito among men, according to Enoch. Oh, he also says his phone is out, so he'll only be on the chat tonight.
Okay, good. Thank you for being there, and thank you for that commentary. So what's interesting for all of us together is, how do you do that? How does this manifest for you? Each one of us has a story of how to do it. And let me just ask people here, what is with hospitality? And maybe everybody here is from a different cultural base or a different country. Certainly everybody has a different history. But how was hospitality in your area? You want to get started out there?
Okay. Get to be the guinea pig. Are you talking about our backgrounds and our communities?
Asking the question.
Our communities of origin. Well, I'm from another country in the sense that I was raised by social workers. You know, my parents were both trained social workers from New York, and you know, this is kind of a less liberal political environment or whatever. But anyway, my parents both actually thought explicitly about compassion. Wretched of the earth, you know, about those who are lesser privileged in society. But, you know, I have to say that I was the, I and my sisters were the beneficiaries of this kind of hospitality that, my parents basically believed that it was always fine, or it was more often than not they would put out another place or two at the dinner table. And you know, my father was in the habit of, he would literally call up in the afternoon to tell my mother, oh, you know, so and so, we have a visiting dignitary, you know, somebody is here from the Philippines, or we have somebody visiting from France or from Africa or something, and he would bring these people home for dinner. And you know, it was fascinating. I mean, because then you would have this, you know, hear these conversations of the adults when I was a child. And you know, the idea was that it was basically my father was working for the state government of Pennsylvania, so he got to meet a fair number of in his field. He got to meet experts and, you know, administrators. I don't know, what would you say, they were like, where there were these meetings and exchanges going on with not only with other states but with people from other countries, and he would often bring his people home. So it was quite educational. It was fascinating.
So you had different cultures coming into the home.
Yeah, but it was also,
That was the environment that they...
But in regard to hospitality, I mean, this was actually, it's a kind of modeling, I think. It was the modeling that we saw as very young children. We saw, you know, that my mother would never say, oh my gosh, there's not enough food, or, you know, I'm going to have to go to the store, or I'm going to have to do this, or I'm going to have to do that. So just say, oh yeah, that's fine, we set another place, and the people were welcomed, and, you know, they were served,
nice.
You know, they would have dinner, and, you know, and they were treated like family members. I mean, you know, treated like favorite cousins or uncles or
sure.
aunts or something, you know,
Kay,
people that were known.
Did you have something?
Well, my situation is similar to my experience to Ivan, except that we grew up rather poor. And the one thing that I always noticed with my father, later on he did well, but when I was very young, which I think we're impressionable at younger ages more, he was so friendly with everyone. It didn't matter who they were, you know, could be the shoeshine boy or the, we lived in Ohio in a small town. And I think it was his friendly to anyone. And also if someone wasn't feeling well, you know, he just always tried to be cheerful and to take care of him. His reach went further than his own family. I really think that influenced me to, at an early age, it isn't that I don't think about myself, well, I think we all do, we have to, but I also began to reach out and look at other people and actually look to see the places where I might be able to make some kind of a difference in their life, even if it's just to see a smile come to their face by a comment saying, oh, you have a nice dress or whatever.
That's something you notice you're doing.
Yes, and that brings me into my daily life. It's not unconscious because it's very conscious, but, I went into a little restaurant, and the girl at the counter where you order was like, I just always look when I walk in who's in a space. I try to and figure out what's going on. But the girl at the counter was very, very, she didn't care. She basically didn't care who we were, what we were. Oh, yeah, you want that. And I'm not going to go much further with this, but it's later, she came by to pick up the dishes, and my friend and I started to talk to her, engage her, and it was unbelievable, the change. She actually looked very pretty. Before, she looked very, you know, saddened and glum, and I don't know what her situation was, but that's about it, and I think it came from my father. That's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
And online, go ahead. Hand the phone to Galen. if online, if you'd like to share, go ahead and type it into the chat if you have a story or how does it work for you now.
Kay's story reminds me of a situation I was in with our son. We had gone to the grocery store, and there was a woman she was the most abrupt and rude woman that we had started to avoid her line. We'd rather be in a long line than hers. And one day, we looked at each other, and we said, let's go to that line, and let's see what we can do. And so I went, we went up there, and she was not a pleasant person at all, but she had the most unusual earrings on. And so there was my entree. And so I mentioned them to her. And like Kay was just saying, she suddenly, the mask fell. And she, I realized that she was hurting. And everyone has a story that they yearn to tell and they wish somebody would hear them. And we did. We ended up in the line a very long time while she, opened up about some of her life situation. And it was an incredible lesson for us as well.
Let me ask you a question. What about you receiving hospitality?
That's a very good question. I personally find it difficult to receive it because it suggests that you have need, and it suggests that you are less than you'd like people to think you are, perhaps.
That's how it works in you?
I think you're putting me on the spot, which...
Absolutely. Something about that.
I can certainly speak for myself, and I think that yes, it is. It's difficult, but I also, to get back off the spot, I think it's fairly universal that there's a rendition of the Lord's Prayer that I learned once, and one of the lines in it is the power to forgive and be forgiven. And if you think about we're always I think the traditional one is. What is the traditional?
Forgive those who have trespassed against us.
Right, but this one to say specifically that you need the power to be forgiven. I mean, first you have to admit that you need forgiveness, and secondly, you need to be open to accepting that. You have to be worthy of that.
So the theory of hospitality has two parts. There's the host and the guest. There's the voyager and the guide. Okay. So in all cases, the universality of it doesn't matter. What matters is how does it work in me and how can I work with it? And that's the possibility we have here in working in groups is that we might be able to find some granularity on how does it work in me. Go ahead.
So what have we got online there?
So there's a host and the guest. What is your role as a guest? What is your role in accepting the gift that someone is attempting to give you? She said gratitude. That's part of the role.
Bernie LaPont says, a subtle hospitality concept from Rumi. Do not look at my outward shape, but take what is in my hand.
Interesting. It is part of
the... Go ahead, Dan.
I was just thinking of when she was commenting on the Lord's Prayer, it's the whole idea of forgive us as we forgive others is that it's asking to be a channel for grace, basically.
Anybody else want to dive into the water? Here we have a taker.
We have a phone.
Well, I grew up in Colombia, and I come from a family that is from a specific region that is considered one of the most friendly people there. And so I grew up from my mom, my dad, my grandma, and everyone being very kind, and hospitality was a very important thing. And in a way, there is, it represents openness and trust. And it's also because you are supposed to be, to offer hospitality, because you are not just you, you are representing something. So for example, if there's a tourist, you're representing your country, you're representing the city. So that it kind of gives a responsibility. And then if it's just family, then you're representing your family. So it's these levels of groupness that you are part of. So that immediately gives you like this idea of, it's not only me who is acting, it's also my group. So I should act in a way that gives a good image of this group. And also the idea of there are things that they're related with this type of thing, like where to eat, for eat, or for will, or something like that. And also the idea of today for you and tomorrow for me. So is all this reciprocity. And then the idea of being a whole guest is also well taken by the majority of people. I mean, and when we resist, it's more because we don't want to incommodate, actually. So it's the idea of not feeling that you are like in a lack situation, but it's more that you respect your host, so you don't want to, you know, become a weight for that person. But at the same time, you accept that hospitality and you receive it with a lot of gratitude and openness, because there's a relation that is being built. And from there, you can sometimes get an idea of how the person does stuff and things, and I don't know how his life is.
So I was... my family's Mexican. My mother was born in Mexico. My father's family lived in California for 250 years. They were Spanish, then Mexican, then Californians. So, and then I guess then Americans, and then it became a state. And the Mexican culture is enormously open to hospitality, quiet hospitality. The arms are open. They do give you their last set of beans and tortillas, you know, and without ever saying anything to the guest. And I find that I have the same thing that Gail does, is that I have a very hard time accepting. Part of it for me is that I don't want to owe anybody. Was very egotistical on my part. Huge ego of, well. And I feel better about giving because then they owe me?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So that stuff works. And part of our work here in our life is to understand, I'm like that. That actually works in me, that I want to entrap somebody with my helping them. How sick is that? But that's how it works. And it's exactly. And as soon as you start understanding that it's just a program and I am not that, then you can gradually begin to free. But until you see it in yourself and own it, that's who I am. Pardon me. But I don't want to mitigate it either.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
From Bernie, One more for the row. What is done for you, allow it to be done. What you must do yourself, make sure you do it.
You know, I had that's so true. About 4 years ago, I had a severe chest pain. So usually I just gut it out, right? And finally went to the doctor, and the doctor says, I don't know what you got, but you either are having, you know, a gastrointestinal event, or you're in the midst of a heart attack.
Right.
So he says, go to the hospital. So he sent me to the hospital. And as it turned out, the gallbladder had to come out, very painful. And it was fascinating because I was helpless. Painkillers, but it was an interesting experience. But anyway, you're sitting there totally helpless, and then people started giving me help. And I had no option but to receive it. And that's when I learned how to open up a little bit, still learning every day, open up a little bit to the love of others. Ooh, is that hard?
Yeah, that's interesting. Go ahead, Dan, you got something?
Part of it is I was just thinking of the whole Gurdjieffian notion of the universe being based on reciprocal maintenance, that there has to be both giving and receiving, otherwise things don't work.
That theoretically sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Now, how does that work in your life?
Right. So Pianjo says, what? So Pianjo says, being raised on a ranch, my dad would often assign me tasks. One day, he wanted me to repair a windmill with an old gentleman named Mr. Ortega, who spoke only Spanish. I complained that I spoke no Spanish. My dad suggested this would be a hospitable time to learn some.
Interesting.
Yes, yeah, so there's an interesting construction
so
of hospitality.
Hospitable,
yeah.
To put in the effort to understand the environment you're in. Let me say that again. And this is what Pianjo's telling us. He's an environment in Texas where it's, you know, it's a Spanish culture, mostly Mexican, but it's a Spanish culture, and yet he never learned Spanish.
Yeah, actually, I can feel for that because I lived for 7 years in Tucson, Arizona, and I learned a little bit of pidgin Spanish, but I felt remorse almost constantly in Tucson.
Because you're not.
Well, I was working with Spanish-speaking people all the time. You know, all the time. I had colleagues, you know, I had fellow workers, I had whatever, you know, people. Anyway, and I felt that I was in.
Go ahead.
Deficient not speaking Spanish.
You were deficient.
Yeah.
Well, I was raised extremely WASP, and it wasn't until I was with some friends who were Jewish that she pointed out to me that, this is so classically American, that I had a culture. You know, I was very much aware of her Jewish culture and some of the, you know, like Hispanic cultures and whatnot. But
where were you physically growing up?
Upstate New York.
Upstate New York, okay.
And one of the things that she had pointed out to me was that if you go to a Jewish event, there's just food as far as the eye can see, whereas if you go to a WASP event, there's enough. Just enough food for everybody and no more. There are no leftovers. And I really think that, I mean, I've seen it certainly in other WASP families, and it is a piece of culture. There's a stinginess that is just part of it.
And it's so deep that we barely know it, we barely see it. We can't even notice it within ourselves. So hospitality has something to do for the act of generosity. Mm-hmm. And when can you be generous? When you can be generous of spirit, you have something to give.
Yeah. You know what, David? It's interesting. What you're saying and now what Galen's saying in several of these comments, what's coming to mind for me is that, you know, I had the great benefit of first visiting. I visited Greece in 1972 because my friend Yori said, because I offered him hospitality in my house in upstate New York, actually, that, you know, he said, okay, well, you're going to come to Greece and you're going to stay with my family, you know, and you're not going to buy any food and you're not going to pay any for any rooms or anything. And so, you know, I did that in 1972. And the thing that I learned there was outside the big city, you know, besides Athens, which has always been like New York pretty much, or is trying to emulate New York, let's say. But I traveled all over Greece. I was there for almost 6 months. And I found everywhere it's completely ingrained, this law of hospitality. Of philoxenia or whatever it is. It's like it's just part of the culture, and it's like educated people, uneducated people, middle class, poor, didn't matter. And I mean, typical of that time. In 1972, actually, I was with my girlfriend, my wife-to-be, actually, we were hitchhiking around in Greece. And I mean, we'd arrive at a town, we could literally dump our packs in the central square and go find a cafe and ask for directions or where we could get a room or something. And we wouldn't worry, we had no fear, you know, nobody would ever touch our packs or, you know, we had no issue about our belongings. But I just wanted to say that what you're saying about this, what strikes me about it is that there's, in the whole of Western culture, let's say, maybe not, you know, where Paula is talking about, or, you know, certain special, you know, in cultures like in Greece, you know, or pockets of culture, there's hospitality. But it seems to me that it's sort of like the post-industrial European habit, you know, is not to offer hospitality. It's not part of our, general cultural process, or, you know, the way that it's not ingrained in us. And so it strikes me about both Gurdjieff and EJ and any other teachers, like even Indian teacher, you know, from any tradition, practically any tradition, talking about hospitality, it's like this is something that's, for us, we have to think about it consciously. In other words, it's something that's a challenge for us.
Yeah.
That we have habits from childhood, habits from culture, habits from mechanicalness that we can change, but we have to deliberately, we have to consciously change those habits, because this is what
but that's what we're
learned.
Doing.
Well, it's so, you know, again, it's probably changed a great deal by the 21st century, but I was it was a privilege. It was an eye-opener for me to experience an entire country, a whole culture, where they would look at you and say, where are you from? And I learned enough Greek that I said, where are you from? Oh, Ameriki, you're from the United States. And the first thing I learned, some of the first Greek I learned was Apotimaros in Ameriki. They said, well, from what place? What place are you from in America? Oh, I lived in Chicago. Oh, my uncle lives in Chicago. Do you know my uncle? You know, they had this concept like, okay, you're both from Chicago. So everybody in Greece had some relative or somebody they knew who had expatriated. So, but what I'm saying is, I'm just saying it was different. The whole culture was shot through.
You could feel it in the culture.
It was a habit. It was habitual. It wasn't something that they rationalized or thought about. It was the way they felt and behaved. And I just don't think that's true of our culture in general.
We have to bring it.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
DePaul says, I grew up in a very small town. We didn't even think twice about having dinner at friends or neighbors' homes or vice versa. It was normal. I realized how unique this was. Parents also spent much time with other community parents at their homes, etc. And then Bernie says, well, finale in hospitality. A beggar went to a door asking for something to be given to him. The owner answered, I'm sorry, there is nobody in. The beggar said, I don't want anybody. I want food.
And then you have the tradition of the mendicants. Really, all over the world, it's not just in India, where they have their begging bowl, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever the universe offers them during the day is what they live on. Go ahead. Yeah.
In a way, hospitality seems to me now that is a reflection of how much detachment one can have, in a way, of not expectation of, oh, I'm going to receive, or but it's just completely given, open, and trusting.
You know, our friend Menlo used to run a, he had a booth where he sold coffee, frozen coffee, and it was very popular. And we were talking about his business once, and he goes, well, when I have a customer come up, I never know who they are. I just, it's a mystery. This person's coming up, and I accept them as such. The great, it, talk about challenging your perceptions. I have, I'm in a business that is, that brings up a lot of emotions in people, a lot of emotions. Money, horribly frightening for just about everybody. Taxes, even more frightening than, and so, and then when people aren't prepared properly, my first thing is I want to judge them for not being prepared. Why don't you have your stuff together? But I have to come to it, and it's, you know, a big effect. It's a big deal, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 effect if they do it improperly. But I have to bring it in such a way that does, I'm not the guy. They are. And then finally, we have our work in hospice. All of us here will wind up in working with somebody in death and dying. Okay, with somebody who is in the hospice, technically in this country is basically when they're Medicare now. And it's, but it's six, if you have 6 months or less to live, you enter into the hospice program. But think about being a hospice worker. Do you remember, were you here when Adelaide, remember her? When I first got here, and I've told this story a number of times, and it's probably driving you nuts, but, you know, I was, EJ assigned Robert and I to take care of Blair. Blair had been in the school for a very long time, associated with it, and he was married to someone named Onigold, and they had split. And he had cancer, and he was getting these chemotherapy things and all of this. And he came to EJ once, I think, and he says, I'm not going to do it anymore because it ruins my life. Why do I keep getting that and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So he decided to suspend those treatments, and he went into a private home. He had a home, right? I know where it is. And he had a room set up for his care. There was no professional hospice at the time. And so Robert and I were kind of in charge of making sure he had 24-hour coverage. It was a vigil. And Adelheid was just a very standard German bookkeeper type. I mean, she just, boom, she was there, right? Strong, powerful, unyielding. And when it was her shift, you saw something happen in that room that was, to me, the pinnacle of hospitality. It was extreme awareness of Blair, but non-intrusiveness. She did not invade the space with her own stuff. Does this make sense?
Yeah, that's Adelheid, yeah.
How hard is that to do?
Yeah, that's
real hard, you know. Those of us who have giant egos want to be heard and noticed and oh, he's the guy that's helping me, and or he want to be noticed. She was almost invisible. She could almost disappear.
I think that's what, you know, that reminds me of Castaneda writing about impeccability. You know, that's what she, you could call that impeccable.
She was impeccable
behavior. She also was, boy, I mean, she could bend your ear for quite a long time about the children in this community. She had a lot of compassion, and she had a lot to say about how the children should be treated in this community, which surprised me. Every time she bent my ear on that, I was like, what am I talking about the children here for?
And she never, I don't believe she was ever in a relationship. She's never married and definitely did not have
children. Well, she had a very strong feeling for every child.
She was very close to my daughter, Sarah. So we just touched on a few different things on hospitality. But this is like, we're the explorers, okay? We're the explorers. The map is in front of us, and different people have to go out and explore different areas. And what we're exploring is the inner world. And right now we're exploring the inner world. We're on the part of the map that says hospitality. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So go out and have your notebook and draw what you see when you get to that crevice in the road, or you get to that, you see a stream, you know, on a map, you'll mark it down. What are you going to mark down? So bring this. I'm going to be gone for a week, and I'm going to be in an environment that is very foreign to me. And so I'll be seeing how I can exercise that. Go ahead, Dan. I'm sorry.
So Grocki is in, and I asked him a question about what you mentioned earlier in India. He says, he found this online, the Sanskrit saying, Atithi Deva Bhava, or the guest is truly your God.
That's what I had heard.
Tradition.
The guest is your God.
Yeah,
and you know, maybe Hermes or Zeus or Athena.
Or Elijah
aren't going to show up. That doesn't mean, or does not diminish that saying that the guest is your God.
Because
it isn't your external behavior, but it's in your internal behavior that's important. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, even biblically, there are supposedly visits from, like I believe Abraham had a visit from three angels, but all, and he offered them hospitality. But I'm thinking in the New Testament, there's a saying from Jesus that is, as you've done to the least of mine, so you have done to me.
Yeah, that's exactly the same teaching. It's actually a similar teaching.
So what I'm saying is that we have to take, since we're the advanced students here, okay? We have a lot of time and grades here. So now interpret it tomorrow in your life. You know, how are you going to, where's the God that will come to you tomorrow to which you have the opportunity to provide hospitality. Fascinating.
We're about out of time. I was going to say,
go ahead,
Ivan. I could tell, you know, I'm sure I'm repeating myself, but I could tell this, you know, there's a really magical experience that we had with the study group in Tucson, Arizona, was that we had, you know, a couple of times we together these invocational dinners according to the guidelines which are in this chapter. It's in the hidden work of the seven bodies of man. Maybe George can help me out. But I believe it's in seven bodies of man. You know, there's a process, an outline for how you do an invocational dinner. And, you know, we set this up and we did it as a study circle. And one of the items of the invocational dinner is that you set an extra place at the table and you put out a glass and that you're open to, you know, the idea is that the stranger, back to this principle, that the stranger is welcome at your door. You know, and this was in Tucson, Arizona. I don't remember. It wasn't the height of the summer, but we were doing this at somebody's house, having our invocational dinner, you know, at six or seven in the evening. It was quite hot outside, you know, so yeah, the door was open. It was a screen door, and we had maybe about a dozen or 15 people around the table that we had invited friends and so on. And we set the extra place, and we're sitting down, and I mean, literally, before, the idea was to do the reading. You read this chapter before the meal, you know, the actual chapter from EJ's talk about invocational spaces or invocational dinners. And we were just sitting down and getting set to read this reading, and sure enough, there was a knock on the door, and we go, say, what's going on? And we go in, and it was some guy came in off the street. He knocked on our door. He had looked in the door and seen that we were getting ready to sit down for dinner. He said, well, can I join you? And we said, oh, sure, here, we have a place for you. So the guy sat down. He listened to us. He was very polite. We didn't know him. We didn't know who he was. He was probably a street person in Tucson, but he listened to the talk of EJ's that we read. He made comments, participated, and he had dinner with us. It was very unusual. We were all, the thing I have to say about that is that there was something magical about it, because everybody was sort of like, it was like it lit us up right at the beginning of this invocational dinner. Yeah, it was like we're saying, oh, okay, we got this stranger here, so we better do everything. We better do the best job possible, because this guy has been attracted. He's been like a magnet. He came to sit at the table with us. So I must say that it's never happened to me at a Passover Seder, because Elijah has never shown up. But
it happened in Tucson.
Yeah, it happened in Tucson, and that was about like 1980 or 81 or something like that.
And he seemed to know the rules of being a guest.
This guy was like, it was actually very uncanny, because he was completely, casual about the whole thing. It was like, oh, can I join you for dinner? Yes, please, sure, come on in. Okay, and he just sat down. Okay, very good. Could I please pass the bread? You know.
Good work.
It was really unusual. It was an unusual experience, I have to say.
Yeah.
I mean, because we're sitting there reading, and we're reading this talk, and it says, be sure to set this extra place so that, you know, the stranger who comes to your door can be invited in to share the meal. So, okay, sure, fine, you know, and that's what happened. Anyway, I'm sure I've told this story before, but it's along the line. I think it's also part of the law of hospitality is that semi-magical idea that, a baseball movie or something, that if you build it, they will come. It's like, okay, if you have the vision to do something that you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but you know,
you have to be open to it.
You may help produce that outcome.
How are we doing over there, Dan?
Grocky has another comment. In the wonderful movie Godspell, there is a scene where the modern day embodiment of Jesus is reprimanding one of his disciples for having earlier treated someone badly, and added the line about, and so as you do this to the least among these, you do it unto me. She responded, well, if I had known it was you, big boy.
Yeah, and the difference.
Oh. And Piangio said, in the book of Hebrews, we are reminded that we may be hosting angels unaware. Patricia has a story about this, and I don't know it, so I can't really relate it here, but maybe we can ask her next week. But I just remember EJ. It was amusing to him what happened. So.
So we call it when she's back.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Tell her story.
Thank you for that, Dan.
Could you tell us what we're going to do for next week, since we're going to do it without you? I just need a little preparation.
I won't be here next week.
Okay.
And. Ivan, and apparently Pat's not going to be here too, right?
That's what I heard last week.
But we're fortunate enough that I believe Paul is going to help out and help guide the group through the next chapters of Secret Talks 5, Work of Groups.
Okay, so we'll take on the next few chapters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason I brought this particular book, which you never got to, because I babble on too much, this is Secret Talks 7, okay, part of the Secret Talks series, and this one is called The Great Laws, which has not been made into a public
No.
And chapter 4 is called hospitality. But as usual with EJ's writing, it's not like a technical writing on hospitality.
I looked at that early, and for once I was hoping to find something that read like stereo instructions.
I know, you were looking for that. Did you read the commentary?
I perused through it, yes. Not the commentary yet. I have to look at that.
Commentary is right after.
But what I noticed, what I took away from that is that a couple of times he talks about the fact that refusing hospitality is a great sin. And that is to say, refusing to offer it.
Refusing to offer. What about just refusing to accept it?
I don't think that was mentioned, but
talk about
it's that. Implied.
But we should talk about the other thing he talks about in this is that in his house there's certain things that you never do, like he was talking about the expression of anger. So therefore, you keep your house set for hospitality. Another level of work.
Well, the guest has obligations also, like to bring a certain attitude and to bring gifts. If the guest can bring gifts, the guest should bring. So you might say the guest is asked to bring the gift of not being angry.
It's mentioned that there's sort of a 3-day rule where if the guest is ignorant of the rules, it's tolerated for 3 days. After which he's asked to, yes.
You have to start working.
Yeah, and then it's digging ditches after the first 3 days.
Yeah. So anyway, that's in volume 7 of The Secret Talks. You might want to take a look at it. But look at other literature on hospitality. It's very rich. And find out what it's like in your own life, okay? So anyway, thank you everybody for coming. And we'll see you here next week, and I'll see you here in a couple of weeks. Good night.
Good night.